Welcome. Hello. Actually, I'm pretty happy I have a remote for my PowerPoint, but I think I won't use it. But anyhow, welcome to my solo presentation. It's actually a solo presentation because I actually wanted to invite two or three of my friends from Europe to be on this panel, but they couldn't afford the flights over from Europe, so I'm alone here. But that shouldn't disappoint you. My name is Johannes Grenzfurtner, and today I will be talking about gorilla.com. Actually, I was quite surprised that you pronounce it the same way as the ape, but that's good. Gorilla.com. And I welcome you, my fellow nerd assholes. I'm one too, so don't worry about that. It's good to see you and to talk about the absurdities of power. So, by now, you have probably read the short description for this lecture saying information and political education are completely useless if nobody wants to listen. And of course, you have underlined that part in your papers. And if you haven't, then please do so now. This is very important for your job, being part of the info worker semi-elite. As we all know, we live in an age that has been deemed the age of communication. And calling it this has done us all a huge favor, because now we know that it's all about communication. And it's about global communication we are talking about here. Global communication is organized and institutionalized by big machines, and we call these machines the media. And media is a word for lots of things that we need to communicate. There has always been media, such as our faces and probably our hands, which we frequently use to get something across to one another. I don't think I'm an exception here. I like to talk with my hands a lot, but I should skip that. For a couple of years now, we have media enabling us to communicate over large distances. And this has massively changed our world and as well as our reality. Now our reality, let's say our houses and our streets and our towns and our habits, is supplemented by faraway realities of faraway houses and faraway streets and faraway towns and faraway habits. On MySpace, for example, we can have friends that might not even exist, and we still keep befriending them and feel great about it. As a result, our world has become bigger and smaller at the same time. And this, let's call it worldwide world, is no longer a world constituted by direct action in the way that, say, our, let's say, garden is by our gardening efforts. Gardening the modern world means gardening the media. The media we live in, the garden, the media garden we live in, is a media garden in which we act and react. Every real world problem has to be represented in the media system to be real, or at least to be real to us. Even if something might finally kill us, like global warming will, the media has to tell us now that some such will happen maybe sometime in the future. So at least we shouldn't act surprised while we are croaking. We all know, and most of us probably understand, that the major power of today's world is the media. Whoever controls the media controls everything. And since the media is not nature, but culture, Western culture, that is, it is always owned by somebody. There is no such thing as free media. no matter how deeply stupid liberals might yearn for it. Actually, I'm a leftist. That's why I'm complaining about liberals. Okay, again, there is no such thing as free media. Liberals won't believe that, but it's the fact. And I'm going to prove it to you. Okay, let's say. That's not on record now, but I think it's good. Okay, that was like a small demonstration about how the world works. Media is always owned by someone. I own some, you own some, but most of it is owned by, well, someone else. Like the guy who created Twitter or whoever else. So about 35% of the media is owned by Bill Gates, as a recent study suggests. I asked my friend David to do this study in his lunch break. I gave him $20 for his work. I offered him $25 if he could actually find that it's actually 45%. But he said nobody would believe that. And so we agreed on 35% for $20. That's my friend David with his $20. And that's his study. Okay. And now you understand why Bill Gates is called Gates of Perception. So, now we understand that media is the strongest political, economic, and of course, juristic power in the modern world. And most of us do not own significant parts of it. It's not big, isn't it? Okay. So, and that's stupid because we should own a lot more and we want to own a lot more. So if someone wants to do anything about that, he could probably hack the system. And I know you really want to hack the system in order to add something to the system, like stupid marketing concepts for, like this one, for stupid products. And I tell you what, you need a concept that's called guerrilla communication. And I'm about to tell you what that is and how it works as a way to help you put together a stupid marketing concept for a stupid product. To get on my stupid nerves afterwards, so dumb as me, but that's fine. I also know that you don't want to change the world in general because you're living on the sunny side of it. That's only natural, and you won't go to hell for it because there's no such thing as hell to punish you for what you have been done in your lives. And I wish sometimes there was a God to beat you up in the afterlife for what you have done in your capitalist systems, but there isn't. You lucky bastards. Guerrilla communication intends to wage war on the media system. And to wage war on a reality that is produced by this system, or even the system system. Using a word as guerrilla suggests that there is a war going on, and it suggests that media tries to constitute and preserve the status quo. This is the status quo of a society in which knowledge and information are not only means of controlling people, as you U.S. American-type liberals might fervently acclaim, but also to segregate people into classes like the working class and the networking class. And that's you, by the way. So, dear fellows of the networking class, to separate people into poor, rich, and more or less rich. That is to say, U.S. American liberals who are startled about the fact that government could attain too much control and might cut down their motherfucking liberal privileges as class, sex, race, and birthplace. Just to add that. So, what can be done about it? How can you fight these powers, which also make sure you can keep your privileges as the ruling knowledge elite? Let's see what the classic guerrilla communication suggests here. The determining factor of guerrilla tactics is to launch small but effective operations to attack an enemy, which is much bigger, but also a little lame, due to a certain degree of formal institutionalization. I made it. And these tactics are taken from classical guerrilla warfare, which already made use of plenty of guerrilla communication to disturb, confuse, or to interrupt its enemy's communication system. But there is a difference between a military or paramilitary guerrilla and guerrilla communication strategies. The latter is not aimed at just like overthrowing its enemy and to basically put the foot on its face and itself in its place. That's almost like Dr. Seuss. No, it's not. Guerrilla communication does not want to defeat mainstream media as a whole. It doesn't want to exert capital punishment, genocide, suppression, or whatever classic male military intention there might be else. And I suspect, you little capitalist market war info soldiers out there, that it is this which you're into. And I tell you, this is the reason why you are here, all keen to learn about guerrilla communication to retrieve into your small, smelly offices, to wipe out somebody who you feel is an unnecessary obstacle in your way to economic success. And I'm sure you'll attend a panel covering mobbing communication right after this one. But oh, wait, it's the last one. Ah, whatever. Okay. Other than military guerrilla communication aims to interfere in the monologue of bourgeois media mainstream and to show how reality and normality are being created by having control over the media and publicity and the public space. That looks like that, by the way. It is inspired by various theories in power. It includes positions that tend to focus merely on the government. That's always, whatever. On the government, just like many, many liberal traditionalists like that, and excludes any other factors from the analysis, feeling no need for showing a more complex portray of social powers. But guerrilla communication theories might also include left-wing or even Marxist positions, pointing out that all power is derived from the social factors underlying and forming a society, such as class, race, and sex. We have talked about that before. My position in this would, of course, be that normality and reality are created within such a structure. That means to attack normality and reality would also mean to attack this very structure. And something which theorists have referred to as semiotics of reality or social semiotics, if you want to note that down, please. Have you? Yeah, you have. In a media-based society, and of course there is no such thing as a non-media-based society, consisting of more than one person, it is the science and significance. The meanings and habits and conventions of speaking and thinking, the images and stereotypes which control nearly everything. It's what is represented and how it is represented, and of course, what is not represented, that's really important, what is not represented and how it lacks representation. It's not so much about, like, let's say, Rupert Murdoch, okay, whose, assholeness I will not dispute. We shouldn't attack Rupert Murdoch. We should rather attack something else. And I would call it the cultural grammar of the public space, which consists of the media space, of course, and of the space as well, like as streets, places, baseball stadiums, or whatever games you play. Power is formed within such a grammar, such a cultural grammar. Access and non-access to each and everything is regulated in its realm. So meanings are basically negotiated here. Good and evil, and that's, for example, good, are determined. So bourgeois morale, yeah, you see it here, is defined as the morale of the ruling elite and then forced upon everybody else through bourgeois jurisdiction and prisons locking away those who won't comply to their position in the social class, race, sex structure. And of course, this structure is not a free gliding or like a mystical pattern that you would find on like a Windows MP3 player. But merely the effect of class and race and gender management in society. So guerrilla communication tries to understand the processes by which the media come up with social frameworks of behavior and perception. And by understanding what's going on here, it also tries to introduce tiny symbolic changes to that system in order to make people suspicious of information. Wanting to understand the ideological structure and goal it transports. Guerrilla communication urges us to reconsider what we believe and also what we believe to believe and whom we do believe and why. Moreover, it tries to point out that media is forcing Gleichschaltung onto people, alignment. It's medial alignment, it's social alignment onto people by censoring facts that don't fit into the picture. And it tells us that information and the media should be free. Maybe one should mention Wikipedia, like in this context, yeah, the nice logo of Wikipedia. But most of the people involved do not realize that there is no such thing as free media in a capitalist, bourgeois, liberal society. A free good on a free market is, number one, a nice gadget. Number two, a simple freebie. Number three, a marketing tool for something else. Or four, merely a paradox. And if you disagree, feel free to come up with an existing example which doesn't fit in any of those categories. Categories, whatever you pronounce it. There are wide ranges of strategies guerrilla communication could use. Most of them have something to do with mocking or mimicry, I think it's mimicry, of official communication, with faking and rearranging it in the process. These strategies are useful in attacking a single player like a multinational corporation, doing very wrong by trying to stain his image and tactically embarrass him as a warning to stop the evil doing, like what's happening here. You shouldn't do that. Let's do guerrilla communication to stop you doing that. Of course, the multinational corporation wouldn't stop, but at least we could point out what's going on. While this rather useful strategy is pointing out the power of the public as buyers and non-buyers, as consumers and non-consumers, it still remains within the construct of good and thoughtful capitalism, like this one. No. That's the good one. That's the good one. And that's the evil one, the evil twin of capitalism. And I don't believe there is an evil twin of capitalism. It's just evil as a whole, okay? It doesn't dig too deep under the surface of the media world. It's like half-assed guerrilla communication and perfectly fit for a middle class, occasionally caring a little bit about the worst and most unbearable effects of capitalism. Okay, I like that. I think I should have it on there at least for 5 more seconds. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, beep! Another strategy would be decoding information techniques and processes. The idea here is that publicity itself means to expose yourself and therefore you can be attacked. Advertising has to be placed somewhere in public. And as soon as something tries to give instructions, it can be obeyed or it can be disobeyed. Of course, if there is a billboard, you can hack it or not hack it, or you can obey it or not obey it by simply not playing by the rules. You could, for example, decide to not buy a specific product as long as it is advertised. This might become your personal individual strategy of guerrilla communication. But it sucks because, unfortunately, it's always the best products which are advertised because they are advertised. So there is no such thing as free and individual taste. But advertising wants you to believe in the freedom and individuality of your taste, which doesn't even exist empirically, that is. And here's the proof. You can, too, sabotage instructions by misinterpreting them and acting dumb, for example. That goes for the factory workers who are, of course, excluded from Congress like this, but also for your white-collar supremacist colleagues. Let's try something. Why not use a CD drive in your office computer as a coffee cup holder? Why not? Ever tried it? It's got a tinge of freedom to it, which of course you wouldn't want to experience because it's dangerous. It's the freedom of something that exists beyond the mere functionality the way it was intended. So use it. And even if you move out now, use it. Oh, wait. Are there some hackers here? They probably do that all the time. Okay, good. I'm wrong audience. Sorry. Anyways, one of the basic strategies has to be faking things. So faking is really, really, really important. Press releases by political parties, for example, or companies, websites like the one the Yes Men did, one of the most famous guerrilla communication groups of all times. Via the fake websites, they received correspondence from other players on the information market, for example, the World Trade Organization and other big players. And they're being invited to speak at conferences of the World Trade Organization or wherever else. And one of the biggest hoaxes was a BBC World interview as a Dow chemical spokesman at the 20th anniversary of the Bhopal toxic gas accident in India. And this accident resulted in 3,000 deaths and 120,000 injured and still suffering badly from the effects. So Dow Chemical, who is in charge of the responsible company Union Carbide, always refused to pay compensations for the case. It's a couple of billion US American dollars. They never paid it, of course. But the Yes Man activist Andy Bichelbaum, you see him here, under the name of Jude Finisterra, he claimed during his interview that Dow Chemical was finally willing to take responsibility and to pay $12 billion. And shortly afterwards, Dow Chemical, of course, denied that, and their stocks dropped rapidly. So there was a guy basically playing a businessman, and he crashed the market, the stock value of a big corporation like Dow Chemicals. Okay, to sum it up, you would say that it's all about playing with representation and identity, with alienation and identification, and at least through over-identification, which means that you use affirmation to a degree that goes far beyond what is conventional in order to show what something really means, but also to act out the habits and conventions of your enemy. So guerrilla information, for example, uses classical marketing tools and knowledge in exactly the same way it is always used, but twisted in the opposite direction. This works for press releases and interviews as well for personal habits. Like what you wear and how you look and whatever. So the Yes Men, for example, are masters of the typical company spokesman body language and tone of voice. So what they do can no longer be called a parody, although they are using parody and satirical points, but it's rather impersonation. And I really like that. So you really like get into the role and you impersonate a Dow Chemical spokesman, and then you succeed. So you could call this strategy the illegitimate. It's what is stupid language? Illegitimate occupying of speaking positions in a world in which some people and players have more power to speak and a louder voice than others. While classic counterculture media could hardly ever have such an effect on the public due to its natural limitations. Hijacking and faking the channels and speaking positions means to get messages out with a lot more power and a lot of more urge. So you could say that guerrilla communication is not trying to destroy the dominant codes, but rather to deconstruct and strategically abuse them. And of course, to use them for its own purposes. Now we understand that guerrilla communication doesn't have a military goal like destroying and overtaking anything or suppressing or overruling anybody or exterminating a special group of people. No, it's more about bringing a special group of people like the people of Bhopal on the map of global consciousness. Most of the time, guerrilla communicationists are not so much concerned about themselves, but it also, that the media attention for themselves, as well as the possibility of upgrading their human capital, let's call it, or as ethical rebels and skillful pranksters, adds a lot of motivation. For example, I mean, who doesn't want to get on the cover of Hustler? Actually, I can't really believe that, because they're actually nice guys, and it's like quite a sexist magazine, so I'm not sure I would do that, but at least they are pranksters, they are guerrilla communicationists, and they're on Hustler. Interesting. Okay, to sum it up, guerrilla communication is a versatile practice of cultural resistance. And the earliest forms of modern guerrilla communication are to be found within the World War I art scene. And that's pretty exciting, I find. When a group of international artists and deserters met in Zurich on neutral Swiss ground to launch the Dada movement. Dada was the precursor of modern and postmodern radical art movements, such as the Situationists International, the punk movement, or Neoism. A major concern of Dadaist art was to cut in on all forms of artistic activities, such as painting pictures or writing lyrics. Instead, they were looking for new forms of art to find it fitting for the modern world. So they started as noise mongers with pretty radical performances. And soon they began to manipulate the press by distributing fake press information and fake press releases. In a way, the Dadaists worked with the media like other artists worked with paint or metal for sculptures. They also cut and recut pictures, words, and lines from newspapers and assembled them in collages and montages. And sometimes of like really like grotesque and sometimes like highly political content. Later on, they launched interventions in public space, attacking major institutions of the post-war society. The so-called Oberdada, that's how he looked like, the chief Dada, Johannes Bader, he was one of the first performance artists of the 20th century. And he managed to confuse the attendance of a church service at the Berlin Cathedral by reading out a very, very bizarre sermon. So he was basically saying, I want to do the sermon today. And what he read actually didn't really fit into a church. And it was pretty, 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 pretty grotesque. For example, he distributed leaflets with entitled The Green Corpse. The Green Corpse, nice. And he was throwing them over the gallery of the German National Assembly in the 20s. And by doing that, he catapulted or transferred Dada into like a media company in a certain way, a non-commercial media company, actually. And he hacked the bourgeois media with that. And I think it's the first time that ever happened. These interventions broke ground for a lot of late modernist art and subcultural strategies, attempting to model the public space or the social world rather than holding on to classical art stuff such as painting pictures or sculpturing. A vast group of dropouts emerged during the high times of Western counterculture, from the beatniks to the punk movement. These people developed strategies to provoke and challenge society to implement their political agenda into the public space and to start reclaiming the streets, just like a slogan has it. The street is synonymous for public space and the humdrum surface of society. Therefore, it was considered the perfect stage, the perfect stage for informing people on the streets, or let's say for counter informing people. Most activists came from a classical counter-informing, from a classical arts background, or journalist background, some of them. But they had experience that nobody really listens when you speak in a traditional art space. So your average guy, let's say that's your average guy, your average guy does not go to exhibitions. He does not go to concerts, maybe to Dolly Parton, but I don't know. And he doesn't go, he doesn't get in touch with counterculture media. So how could we reach that guy? Counterculture and the art world are niche places. They are definitely niche places. And you see, it's a niche place because all the people are sitting next door and watching the 2025 Web 2.0 panel there. We are in a niche place. So art is a place where things might be reflected, but most people don't like to reflect things. But that amounts nothing because it's not linked to everyday life. It's just art. So it's about something the elite is involved. Art is a special task and a special place for special people. Bottom line. That's it. I could stop now, but I'm going on. So, it's something the elite is involved with buying its high-priced products of criticism. This is the classical drama of bourgeois art in a bourgeois society. Same is true for bourgeois journalism. It simply keeps embodying the same old role as a critical sidekick of the powers to be. Critical sidekick, that's it. The shiny good cop to its bad copness. So, there's so much criticism out there. We can write about everything. We can write about that. We can criticize Bush. We can criticize that. What? What the fuck? Nothing changes. Nothing. There's criticism all over the place. But it's still the same bullshit going on for a long, long, long time. I'm just talking so long here that you really can see the picture, okay? Ah, good. It does a good shoe-shining job within a system that neither opposes nor represses it, but generously grants art and literature and journalism to feel free to criticize and to complain. And nothing changes. Around the 1960s, a lot of strategies emerged to confront the men and women in the street right where they were to escape the bourgeois art world's limitations. The first happenings were staged referring to Dada, and a lot of street theater groups popped up everywhere. Street theater, that's really an interesting one here. That's Valley Export from Austria, huh? My home country. And it was a street theater. She was walking around. She was naked under that box. And she was actually inviting people, would you try? Would you like to feel that? And of course, the people, mainly like men people, were, of course, taking advantage of that. And it was like one of her strategies to like overexpose sexism in a certain way. That's like, you should check it out on Google and Twitter it out. Valley Export, 1967. Da-da-da. Okay, good. Okay. Good. Street theater ranged from conventional plays acted out amidst the shoppers and passers-by to role plays where the audience did not even realize they were watching a play or being part of a play. The post-bourgeois artists were trying to break the art, they were trying to bring the art back to the people and in a certain way break the art. Not as a handy service, as it is to most of the elite art consumers, but as a form of irritation. This is this was one of the many, many starting points of guerrilla communication. And also of the so-called Reclaim the Streets movement. I think that's a pretty good picture of like how art is being born, I think. Like a farmer is dragging a small embryo out of a sheep. I think I like that. It's good. Okay, so The so-called Reclaim the Streets movement included funny yet irritating activities like, for example, flash mobs you can see it here, and other flash mobs like this one. I think you know that guy. Okay, and for example, the Adbusters movement. To adbust means to bust and destroy advertisements and other inscriptions in the public space that epitomize the vulgar capitalist idea they are trying to sell. And there is no such thing as a public space out there, but only private spaces belonging to those who buy or rent them. Everybody is an adbuster, at least sometimes, because everybody has busted advertisements in his life. For example, you can have a billboard like this one, and you can park your car in front of it. And that's basically adbusting. It really is. Yeah, it is. It's like a small form, but it is. Or you can have a dog and let it pee on an ad. Why not? Why not? And if the internet is a public space, you can block up pop-ups. The possibilities are endless. So there's a great variety of adbusting techniques, and only a small percentage might get you into serious trouble with the law. More severe interventions include pasting over advertisements, tearing them off, graffitiing, or otherwise commenting on them, rendering them impossible, changing the messages, or the like. These are not necessarily very refined ways of attacking ads, but rather spontaneous expressions of disgust and frustrations with advertisements in general, or a specific ad or displaying, for example, like racist or sexist images. Like, people get angry about that and they try to destroy or alter it. If you take into account that the average person receives up to 3,000 advertising messages every day, you will understand that advertisements cause aggressions and frustration, and you need to let off steam. And I encourage that. In the 70s, counterculture split into the more traditional Marxist wing, consisting of small parties and groups that wasted lots of their precious time and precious youth to fight each other, and a less dogmatic movement, which was called, at least in Austria and Germany, the so-called Spaßguerilla. Fun guerrilla, or the so-called Sponti movement, to emphasize its spontaneous Sponti movement, spontaneous and site-specific character. Plenty of the activities which were conceived at that time, like throwing pies at celebrities, are still around in the guerrilla communication movement of today. They too started working with so-called fakes, fake information and actions distributed via bourgeois media, oblivious of the fact it was spreading a hoax. A popular slogan had it that the basic idea was to invent false facts in order to create real events. Die Erfindung falscher Tatsachen zur Schaffung wahrer Ereignisse. But they too made real object fakes and did cultural piracy stuff like pirate editions of socialist classics or handing out well-faked subway tickets. Pirate radios turned like to be a really nice form of this, like the famous Radio Alice in Italy, and appeared and hijacked radio frequencies. Graffiti was an important weapon of that movement to override the text of the city. And in its best and most far-out moment, they came up with the postmodern idea that social structures are texts too. They're texts, and therefore can be overwritten in the same way you can overwrite an advertisement. At the same time, the squatters movement emerged. And, well, these were post-bourgeois artists in the very literal sense of the word, attacking actual private property as well as non-material cultural property. So the good thing about guerrilla communication is that, unlike everybody else, it shows no respect for the fact that the media and public space are always owned and in the hands of the bourgeois elite and semi-elite, as are the images and cultural frameworks we live in. And its central and basic strategy is to misappropriate images, words, radio frequencies, and to shift them to different contexts. In France, for example, the famous and influential Situationist movement defined a form of art called détournement. Like, you can imagine what it means in English. Détournement. It means that you roam aimlessly around the streets, for example, Paris or Austin, Texas, and whatever you find, you take it and you bring it somewhere else. And that for a couple of hours. And you wouldn't see, you wouldn't believe how much the streets change. Like if you move around things that are on the streets that actually can be moved. Okay, so a lot of these activities were and still are strictly illegal. Therefore, guerrilla communication activists had to develop forms of camouflage and hiding away behind multiple names and open pseudonyms. Like, for example, Luther Blissett. So, who's Luther Blissett? Luther Blissett is like a multiple persona, multiple person. In the meantime, a detective novel bestseller was published under his name, plus lots of other books and readers and other interesting stuff about subversion and jamming. For example, a really good book by the German guerrilla communication group Autonome Afrika Gruppe. They published their book about guerrilla communication under the pseudonym of Luther Blissett. So pseudonyms don't just grant invisibility for people avoiding the blame. It also lets you get away with violating the bourgeois principle of identity as a person, as an artist, or as an author. The person is, so to say, a nation within the nation. And that is what many people want to attack. And therefore, they are forming a collective personae. And Luther Blissett demanded everybody, the activists demanded everybody to edit their works exclusively under the name of Luther Blissett. And there's really, really good and exciting work out there. So maybe Google that. So in a certain way, guerrilla communication is also a lot like hacking, and I think that relates to you in a little bit. Finally, talking about hacking here. And hacking is, of course, one of the many means of guerrilla communications because it is a hostile assault from outside the system trying to find a way into the system, so to change and to manipulate it from within. And to do so, you have got to know how everything works. You have to understand how the system works to actually being able to reshape it or to reconstruct the identity and reality of a system. So like hackers would do that with like a website when they would like hack the Pentagon or something like that. Actually, that's pretty hard to do. So most of the time they hack like other stuff, but whatever. So what I mean is that not simply, you have to understand how a website looks like and how it's presented. You have to find out how it works in like an ocean of websites, and to finally pick it out and to context hack it in a certain way. Actually, you have to go really deep into the code to be able to manipulate it. You have to understand it. You have to understand the technological grammar of the computer to being able to reprogram it, to hack it, to crash it. And most of you probably even are aware how technological codes are constituting the media. But what are, for example, about other codes, like not the technological code, but like the cultural code of messages? Do we really understand, for example, how heterosexism is cemented in our society via texts and images? And what about cultural stereotypes? How do we, or at least some of us, come to believe that white males from suburban USA are meant to rule the world without even once spending a thought about it or on it? How is the sexist and racist and classist subconsciousness of the liberal society shaped through the media and access to it? Any suggestions? I'm waiting. I thought that. You sure won't have any idea, because it is just the nature of capitalist bourgeois society to keep a constant flow of the same images and stories and pictures. It's the repetition of the same and the same and the same. And that is what's got to be hacked and changed to make it visible and questionable. Only once something can be seen, we will realize what has been invisible before. That's why we need to hack the media flow to bring on some different images and ideas, to hack into media and change its message flow and the stereotypes it communicates. And that's pretty much like a shame, because many people who are into culture jamming are sometimes even like spreading out the same messages. So there are like many culture jammers out there who just like spread like extremely sexist messages, for example. And why is that? So there is always, there has to be a certain dimension to that, a political dimension. That's why I'm a political man. That's why I'm talking about that. Yeah. So of course, and that's the point, we shouldn't just like simply play around with the media. Playing around with the media is bogus. It's what's that? Even a media pirate and a hacker is still part of the system. That's it. We have to change the political economics of a society, I say. And you can quote me on that, no problem. Otherwise, we will just be going round and round and round and round in the same old circles as the history of guerrilla communication clearly shows. Looking back at the guerrilla communication movement, we have to say that besides the counterculture intentions, these strategies were an early form of viral marketing for the rebels themselves, or at least for some of them. Because a great part of the movement has made it nowadays into the top of our society and its institutions. Like, for example, the former German Minister of Foreign Affairs, Joschka Fischer. You can see him here on the right side. And now he looks like that. And he's a complete asshole. Like that. He was part of the Sponti movement in Frankfurt. He was a really, really great guy. He tried to change the world, and that's happened to him. So it's all about success. And sometimes it's even about breaking success. Sometimes you have to stop success to actually something happen. But success is probably what you're here for. Okay, so please do me a favor and at least erase all the information I gave you from your memory now, because maybe not sharing the information would be the utmost guerrilla communication act of all times. Not sharing it, keeping stuff secret, not twittering out everything that's happening out there, and keep a secret somewhere. Keep a secret, and you actually can use that secret. I'm stopping. Pardon? You can write that on a postcard and sell it, my friend, and move to Alabama. Yay! Okay. Good. I don't know. Maybe we can have a discussion afterwards, but maybe it would be good not to ask any questions, because I have the eerie feeling I'm over time anyhow, and maybe we should sing a song together. I think that should be a good thing. Let's try it. Because everything is nice. We sing a song. No questions. Song. Senders, codes, and recipients. I'm an unconventional boy. So many cultural sediments. Intervention is a perfect joy. And even if time ain't really on my side, it's one of those days for a semiotic fight. Pranking can be so much fun. Just do it and run, run, run. Guerrilla communication. Using the absurdities of power. I'm feeling alienation. Liberalism is a golden shower. And even if time is running out so fast, my messages, they never gonna last. But the system, it shall rot, rot, rot. Over-identification is the tool I've got. Da 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 da. Da 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 da. You can be sure that if you're feeling right, a jealous dream will last long into the night. Tomorrow morning you'll face your deepest fears. Post for this may last 10,000 years. I think I got some conference. They'll pay some cash for a heart-hacking man. And I'll be an artist in residence somewhere. Just doing the best that I can. Feels like this could be my last chance. Feels like this could be my last chance. Feels like this could be my last chance. And I think it's my last chance. Thank you very much for listening to me. That's my name, Johannes Grenzwürdner. Part of Monochrome. Actually, I didn't talk a single word about Monochrome today, but I think you liked it anyways. And have a nice evening and get drunk. Or, I mean, if you want to ask me a question, we can do that down there. Yeah, yeah.
There we go.
Yes.
So I wasn't fast enough to answer your question when you answered it. But I think I believe that the reason that things are the way they are is because experience. If you stop and you look at the way all society is built, we build all trust on experience. Mm-hmm. And the reason we believe that we get up in the morning and walk out our door, that there won't be somebody to drag us away or somebody won't have stolen our stuff.
They clap for you next door.
The reason we believe that if somebody steals things from us, we'll eventually have some sort of justice is because we've experienced a set of rules that have showed us that mm-hmm. comes true. So if we want to change society, we have to change people's experience so they can build new trust in new society. So the reason all of us keep accepting the same system that's here every day is because that's the experience that we have, the system we have experience with, and the society that shows us that things are going to work.
Yeah. Many people have like the interesting idea of they get away with their assholeness. And the stupid thing is, they get away with their assholeness.
Experience shows them they do.
So I have a lame marketing scheme.
Yay!
So I don't know if anyone else here besides Robin was in the Bill McKibben panel, but the folks who did step it up a while back on the climate change issue are now mm-hmm. trying to inject the idea of a target of 350 parts per million into consciousness.
Okay.
The problem is that like no single government could make it happen, right? No international mechanism exists for setting such a target. Mm-hmm. So the theory is that McKibben laid out was that it would need to just pervade world opinion or get out there mm-hmm. the number 350, a quantitative measure of what we need to do in terms of climate change. Okay. Short of having the Bush administration release a press release saying we're going to shoot for 350 parts per million, which would be a little difficult to pull off, I think. How could it be injected into cultural grammar, as you described?
Yeah, cultural grammar, like, as I said, it's always good to inject, like, memes. I'm not pretty sure, like, because, like, from the philosophical standpoint, I don't really believe that there's something like a meme. I don't believe that something can exist outside a person. And people who are like into meme theory actually try to sell us the idea of that information can exist without a person. And I don't believe that. But okay, just one example. I don't think it's guerrilla communication. Maybe it is. I don't know. But society, like the structure of society, the structure of basically everything is defined by language. So there's basically, that's like a highly radical constructivist like approach. There's nothing beyond language. So for example, I think that the worst thing that happened to the to global warming, like not to global warming, to like what happened to oppose global warming, or like is the name itself. Global warming sounds actually nice. It's a nice term. So if they would have called it, for example, atmosphere cancer, there would be a completely different discussion about that whole topic, atmosphere cancer. It's like one stupid idea about marketing. So how to call stuff.
The problem is that they've gone with climate change. It's like one term shift. Other people say like climate destruction, climate disaster, et cetera. It's just that nobody knows what we're talking about when we say that, right? So now we're in a system where either we have to work within the existing structure of communication and try to hijack it or move it in some way, not necessarily hijack.
Or
we have to start all over, right?
The problem is there's nothing beyond our normal media society. So there's not a single... That's the whole thing I was trying to tell you about, this constantly referring to this capitalist idea of society, because there's nothing beyond capitalism. That's the problem. And the problem about capitalism... I think I would have a long discussion with libertarians about that. But the problem is that in our society, the basic fundamentality of our society is economics. So everything, nearly every aspect of modern life is defined by thinking about economic things. It's the virus of economy that basically took over the planet around 150 years ago. That's actually how capitalism started, because there were many things like money and mass production and that. All the things that were before that, they're older than 200 years. But the mid of the last century, all those really, really isolated things suddenly emerged together into a really totalitarian form. And that's what I call capitalism. That's what the Marxist's definition of capitalism is. That you have a planet that's basically defined by economics. And everything is defined by economics. Like a sentient human being can be it's a calculation. And that's the bad thing about that. And I'm not talking about state communism or crap like that. Don't call me a communist, okay? Please.
Okay, let me see if I can get this question right. I used to be working class, and now I am tech class. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways that I went from working class to tech class was by guerrilla communication, by hacking communication channels to get the message out that I wanted to get about a topic that came up a couple of times in your presentation, which is sex and sexuality. And at one point you asked, how do we reach the average man, and the picture with the man with the cross and the hairy chest and the belly and everything. And one of the I think perfect examples that you gave of hacking and getting the message from the art elite and even now the tech elite to the average man was the Yes Men and the pranks, plural, that the Yes Men did. And then also they made the cover also of Penthouse. So I guess my question to you is, what role do you think sexuality plays? What role does David Fine play? Apparently so. Is there a role for sex?
He's taking away his computer.
Oh, of course he is.
His computer.
Anyway, the question is, what role do you think sexuality plays in guerrilla hacking, communication or bridging the divide, if any, and how sex can be leveraged to do that? Because I saw that, you used the example of the performance artist in 1967 with her breasts in a box, and these have been effective ways of sort of going right up to the average person.
The basic question would be, how can we,
is there a place for sex?
It depends on the culture. You can be highly, 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 highly radical if you're doing something the performance that Vali Export did in 1967.
Mm-hmm.
If you would do that today, I always tend to say nobody would why? Huh?
It's
what?
Less shocking.
They would maybe take a Flickr. One guy would take a picture and put it on Flickr. Maybe. And that's the subversive spark that's in there today. But if you would do that in Iran, they kill you. They fucking kill you, yes. So it's always a matter of context. So you
it's
have
context,
to find...
Yeah.
So in a society that's pretty much open and you can actually do whatever you like, you have to find the spot that you can't do that whatever you like. That's the point. So that's this whole thing between what I would call the shift to a neoliberal society. So in a society that's pretty much wanting you to revolt against itself. There are people out there, the Jackass, for example. Jackass, they are far more revolting and far more gross than anything the Viennese actionists did like in the last 40 years. And they are on mainstream MTV. And of course, they are not like changing anything anymore. What's the point about that? So I think that train is off. But I think that the sex train is not off yet, because we are living in a patriarchal society, for God's sake, for non-God's sake. And I mean, there can be lots of things done there. I think like that, like a sex and guerrilla communication can be, that could be really like an interesting approach in the next years still. Sorry for waiting you so long. I'm so sorry.
Thank you very much. Really enjoyed it.
Thanks.
I've been handing out this swag all conference. It's perfectly free stuff, which is to say that it's designed to market you to come to my website and buy these bumper stickers.
By the way, exactly.
But if you don't want to, that's fine, because I think I'm going to try the artist in residence route if this doesn't work out for me. So that's cool.
But they're up here. Grab them if you want. This is the last of the show.
Yeah. Yay. You're giving all them to me? No.
Well, anyone who wants to get them.
I tell you what. You should directly address your clientele. You should go there and give like all the people are still here stickers. I think you should do that. Why are you talking to me?
If you like the panel or
the
you like the stickers, send me an email, because I'd like to get in touch with like-minded people. So
and now I want like a giant bumper sticker. How was my talking?
Good. Awesome. I have one other question. You've talked on a very broad scale in terms of local versus global, mm-hmm. you know, national, other size groups. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that some things are more suited to one or another. And to what extent do you think this guerrilla communication addresses different size groups or different, you know, geographic or interconnected groups? Because sometimes the geography is not the issue. It's to what extent are people connected? It seems like you have some critical mass issues, but I'm not clear on what your vision is on that.
Yeah. I mean, you have like local activities. There are many, many guerrilla communication activities that are highly local, because people anywhere else on the planet wouldn't even understand what these hacks are all about, because they are highly specific, site-specific, about like a certain culture, there have been a really like interesting things happening, for example, in Los Angeles, in Compton. I mean, that's highly site-specific. I mean, Compton, Los Angeles. I mean, that's not transferable to like Bucharest, Romania, of course, yeah? But still, Bucharest, Romania has like similar problems with that. So I think it's hard to create a recipe for creating dissent. That's basically, I hope I got it out. That was one of my messages. There are many, many, many possibilities. And you just have to filter the idea you have. And sometimes the idea is a billboard hack, and sometimes it should be a fake press release. And sometimes it should be something completely different nobody ever has heard about. Sometimes as like this guy here, hide your face that so they won't recognize you. He started with like a zombie flash mobbing in San Francisco. And it's a stupid idea. I mean, people in as dressed up as zombies walking through the city, what is that? But it's basically the old idea of theater in public space. It's about reclaiming public space. If like 500 zombies are walking out there in the public space and like the bus can drive anymore because of the stupid zombies. I mean, something happened, okay? I don't know if that's important, but actually something happened. And I won't be able to tell you if that's important or not. That's like something that we'll see that probably like in 20 years. I don't know if we're still out there. I don't know. And maybe soon, like the head of a giant, he'll be the head of the Museum of Modern Art in San Francisco, like in 15 years. I don't know. You asshole, I tell you, don't do that to me. Okay. Yeah. I take it with me. Okay. Thanks a lot.